All right. This is Nancy Campbell interviewing Denise Kandel on March 15th, 2007. And you have an unusually interesting prehistory. So normally I ask people to start with their pathway into addiction research. But if you wouldn't mind, could you go back up and give us a little bit of your personal history, where you were born and so forth?
Okay. Well, I was born in France. And I came to the United States in 1949, having spent the war years in France and as a Jew. And I guess that this really has been a seminal experience in my life, because what I find is now I spend a lot of time thinking about, and I'll tell you about this talk, but if you're interested in it, because you're interested in historical research. But I survived the war by being hidden in a convent. And my father, my parents were born in Poland, and they had not become a French citizen because it was extremely hard to become a French citizen at that point. And so my father was one of the first group of Jews who were arrested in France and Paris and sent to a, I would say, an internment camp, not really a concentration camp. It's a very famous camp called Ben-la-Roland. There were two of them, Ben-la-Roland and Pithiviers, which is about 150 kilometers from Paris and near Orléans. He escaped from the camp, thanks to my mother, and then went to the southwest part of France, where he was hidden, and he arranged for me to be accepted in this convent, which was in the southwestern part of France, in Cahors, which is between Toulouse and Bordeaux, if you know where it is. And so I spent 2 years there. And even though I was born Jewish, I knew nothing about Judaism, and I know more about Catholic, you know, Catholicism than I know about Judaism, even though my husband really taught me a lot about Judaism at this point. So I came to the United States, finished my French BA, went to Bryn Mawr College, where I spent 2 years, graduated in 2 years, and then went to Columbia, where I got a PhD in sociology. And my interest, let's just say one more thing about the war years. So as I said, this is an experience that really affected me, and I don't want to go into personal things, but I know some of the ways in which he behaved are due to the fact that I had to hide my identity for 2 years. I couldn't, you know, say really who I was, etc. Didn't live with my parents. But now I've become extremely interested in what my parents, my father's experience was in that camp. So I've done a lot of archival research going into Orléans, which is, you know, as I said, the camps were near Orléans, and they have departmental archives where they actually have, you know, documents from the camps, like registers. Whenever the men used to, it was men at the beginning, they used to go out, they had to sign, and, you know, they had to, it was indicated on a register, and a French policeman, because all the people in the camp were French, even not German. So it's very interesting. There are letters, all kind of documents. I've done a lot of research, become kind of obsessed with this. Anyway, to go back, so I went to Columbia, got my PhD in sociology.
Why did you make the change from psychology at Bryn Mawr to sociology?
Because I was interested in social psychology. But at the time at Columbia, you could take courses in sociology. But you, in terms of major, the major had to be either psychology or sociology. And psychology was very behavioral. That was animal work, which at that time I didn't like, which is kind of, you know, ironic and like what I'm going to tell you later. And I chose sociology, which really was not for me, I think. Because sociology, you really have to think in terms of broad, very broad theoretical and abstract terms. And this was not really the way in which I thought. So I thought I was kind of a misfit, didn't really fit in. And I was also much younger than the other people, because I had gotten to Bryn Mawr as a junior on the basis of my French BA, so I was 17. And so I was 19 when I started my graduate work, so, you know, anyway. So I majored in sociology, and I did my thesis with Merton and Patty Kandel and Herbert Hyman, which was a study of the following medical students and the choice of specialty. And that, it was really a very interesting project because I think it was the first social science project which was modeled on a biological natural science project in the sense that it was a team of investigators working on a single project and everybody was examining a different aspect, and that was not at all the model in the social sciences in those days.
How did that arise?
I think it was Merton. Merton is the one who really wanted to have this done, and he, I think, applied and got a grant to do the study, which was a very famous study at the time called Study of Medical Students. And I think, but there haven't been many publications coming out of it, but anyway. And as I think about it, that study and what I chose to study really kind of influenced me for the rest of my career in a way, because it was a longitudinal study in which the design was that medical students were followed from before the time that they went into medical school and they were interviewed for 4 years. So it was a longitudinal study of young people, and it was really concerned with socialization. How do people become what they become? In this case, how do they become physicians? And I chose as my topic, you know, somebody chose parent, physician-patient relationships. I chose, you know, how do they choose their specialties? And because you had the four waves of data, you could see, do they change? It was really very interesting, you know, because the psychiatrists were a completely deviant group. They came into, because in those days, psychiatry was really, you know, if you were a good student, you went either into medicine or surgery, you didn't go into psychiatry. So psychiatrists came into medical school, they wanted to be psychiatrists, they didn't change their mind, and they graduated, they, you know, went into psychiatry. Which was very interesting, even though there were these very strong stereotypes about what kind of personality goes into medicine and what kind of personality goes into surgery, in terms of choices, there was tremendous amount of change. 1 year, the student would say, I want to become an internist, and the second year would become a surgeon. You know, so there was this back and forth. Anyway, so that was really a longitudinal study and socialization processes. And at the beginning of my career, my professional decision really completely depended upon my husband. I did not have, you know, I didn't say, I want to do this. Let's, you know, he said, I'm going to do this, and so I figured out what it is that I could do, okay? But I didn't feel slighted. I mean, I thought this was a normal, you know, state of affairs.
Yes.
And I don't,
yes,
know. You see, actually, I say we're diverging, but I think that for somebody to be successful in a scientific career, they really have to be completely devoted to it. It's very hard to have two people in a family who are completely devoted to their career.
Indeed. And you had gotten married in 19...
I got married in 1956, which is when the year he graduated from medical school before he started his internship. And I was a graduate student, and I was starting to work on my thesis. So he took an internship at Montefiore Hospital, and I was working on my thesis. I had a little job and working on my thesis. And then, I forget where we were. So when he finished his internship, he went to NIH for 2 years. Initially, it was going to be 2 years. He ended up staying 3 years. And when I was at NIH, there were two former PhDs from Columbia who were there. Manny Rosenberg, who's very well known, and Lynn Perlin. I don't know if you know these names anyway. So I didn't work with them, I worked with somebody else, but, you know, I talked to them. And I did my thesis, and my husband claims the only reason I did my thesis is because I wasn't, you know, at Columbia, because when you work with Merton, you never finished.
Yes, people do say that about him.
Because he had extremely high expectations of people. And so you always had the feeling that could never meet his expectations. You became paralyzed. If you give him a paper, I mean, you would recognize, he would edit, you know, every single word. Anyway. But he was a very... He had a way of formulating a problem that you could really see what is it about the quote-unquote sociological perspective. He was really very good. I mean, he was a very clear thinker. I think he was a very inspiring person, even though really very, very frightening. So I went to NIH, and then my husband decided he was going to go and take a psychiatric residency at Harvard. Then I said, you know, what am I going to do? So I applied for a postdoctoral fellowship. They had a fellowship in those days, which was meant to bring together social scientists and psychiatrists to try to see how, you know, the psychiatrist could learn something about method and research, and the social scientist could learn something about clinical practice. Well, in practice, it didn't quite work out this way. I mean, you ended up doing what you knew how to do, because we were never given a patient and say, you know, try to have to interview or had to diagnose them. So I ended up doing a study looking at patients' records and trying to see what was the match between the social class of the physician, social class of the patient, and whether or not they decided to take them into psychotherapy. Anyway, I almost started a collaboration with my husband at that point. We really got aborted because, I don't know exactly. We disagreed a great deal about how to interpret the records and the symptoms. Anyway, so nothing came out of it. So then my husband decided he was going to take a year off, not the year off, a year in France to learn about aplasia, which turns out to be the animal that he wanted to study, because what we did, I don't know whether you get the sense from reading my husband's autobiography, but I tell him he never really stresses this enough. He took a big gamble in his career because he decided that he wanted to understand, you know, big things like memory and learning, and the only way to approach this was to take a very reductionist approach and work on an invertebrate, a very simple animal preparation. In those days, he was working on cats, and there was really, like in all, that's very relevant to addiction, by the way. I think there's a status ranking of what problems have high status within a discipline and what problems have low status, okay? And in biology in those days, and if you were a neurophysiologist, I mean, you had to work on a vertebrate. If you went to work on an invertebrate, I mean, that was considered to be low status. Now, of course, it's very different now. Everybody's working on the fly, the worm, the mouse, you know, I mean, the mouse is a vertebrate. So, but I must really, and I really supported him in this decision. This is what he says. I played an important role in his career, that I really always supported his academic and research side, you know. And when he finished his residency, he was offered a fantastic job, chairman of this department, that department. I said, this is ridiculous, do your research, don't become an administrator, you know. But anyway, so he took a very reductionist approach. Wait a second, how did I get
there? We were at Harvard.
Oh, yes, yeah, okay. So he decided to take a year off. And you see, because he made this decision, I never really had enough time to prepare myself to do anything. So I went to Paris. I didn't work there. Took care of our son, who was
was he born?
He was born in 65. Wait a second.
It must be earlier.
No, he was born in 61. I'm thinking my daughter was born in 65. He was born in 61. And we went from 60 to 62. So he was a year and a half. I think I have the dates right, yeah. And so when I was at Harvard, so when I came back, I had to look for a job. So, I'll never forget this. I was interviewed by Gerald Klerman. You know his name?
Yes.
Okay. And he was a former husband, Mina Weissman. I'll never forget this interview. He told me, oh, you know, I have this project and I need a project director. You know, you seem very good. He said, but I want to tell you something for the very beginning. Any paper that comes out of it, I'm going to be senior author. I mean, this was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me that up front. I said, well, no, I'm not going to do this. So in the meantime, and this really, this next experience turned out to be very important for me. It turned out that there was a psychologist at Harvard by the name of Gerald Lesser. And Gerald Lesser, you see, was a very important person because he's the one who developed Sesame Street. And he also had done, where's diverging? I don't know if you're interested in all these little details. Am I diverging too much?
No, that's okay. You can divert and we'll come back and we'll...
Okay, I won't tell you about some of the other research that was very controversial. Anyway, I don't know how he got a grant to do a cross-cultural study in the United States and in Denmark. His wife was Danish, so he was very interested in Denmark, okay? And it was going to be a replication of a very famous study done by James Coleman called the Adolescent Society. I don't know whether you know the Adolescent Society. And the Adolescent Society was really a very influential study of high schools in which, I guess, Coleman developed the thesis that adolescents in these high school settings develop social systems in which they're completely isolated from adults, develop their own value systems, and this really leads to the generation gap. Mm-hmm. I knew Coleman because he was a student ahead of me, maybe by 1 year, but you know, and he really was admired by everybody. Every student at Columbia in those days either was a Merton student or a Lazarsfeld student. He was really a Merton and a Lazarsfeld student. He was a student. And I think everybody respected. Do you know his name?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, you know who he is. Okay. So, Jerry Lesser told me, well, if you want to, he basically knew nothing about the study, didn't know how to run, and he gave me a card and said, you could run the study. Well, you know, I mean, I was in 7-7. And I told him that actually I would like to change the design of the study in some ways, because if you're going to look at the influence, if you look at the relationship between parents and kids, you really should get independent data from the parents. So he agreed with me. And this study was really very much a continuation of what I had, in a sense, done in my PhD thesis, because it was a study of adolescent development, and it was really a study, in a way, of the generation gap and parental and peer influences focused upon educational aspirations and occupational aspirations. And we came up with a conclusion, which from a theoretical point of view was very, in a way, interesting and very important in my own development, that you cannot talk of the generation gap as being, you know, an prevalent universal principle that governs the relationship between parents and kids, that actually you have to take a more nuanced approach and think in terms of domains of interest. And for certain domains, like immediate lifestyle-related domain, peers are more important than parents. But when it comes to more lifelong aspirations and concerns, parents are more important. So I started the study when we were at Harvard. I guess when we came back from France.
And when was
wait
that?
A second, you know, I'm giving you the wrong dates. I'm trying to think when we went to France. My husband went to NIH for 3 years. Yeah, I give you the wrong dates for France. My husband went to NIH from 57 to 60. Okay. Then from 60 to 62, we were at Harvard, where he was a resident, I was a postdoctoral fellow. From 62 to 63, or 63 and a half, or whatever it is, we went to Paris. My son is born in 61. So, wait a second. No, I don't have this right. When was I a postdoctoral fellow?
You were a research associate at Harvard from 64 to 69, so this makes sense.
Oh, yes, so I came back from 64 to 60. Okay. In 64, my husband decided to go to 65, to go to New York, to NYU. So I continued working on the project, I mean, with Jerry. He was terrific. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, so I commuted, you know, once a week, then once every day. And I got an office at the Bureau of Applied Social Research, where I was like a kind of, you know, second citizen, because I didn't really have, you know.
And that was here.
And that was here at Columbia. See, and that, okay. I was going to make a kind of very personal association with what, you know, say, how does my experience during the war in the convent affect me in many ways, in many situations. I put myself in situations in which I'm kind of, you know, hidden and not really part of the mainstream, okay? So anyway, so I was in this little office and after several years. But so the Harvard study was very important. And it really got me interested in studying parent and peer relationships in a in an arena where you could see how peer influences manifest themselves. Because I thought we really pinned down how parents influence the education aspiration. So, as I said, my husband was in New York. He moved to New York before this project was over. So, when the project was over, then I started looking for a job in New York, I guess before it was quite over, because I had continuous employment. And I obtained a job at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, which was a research job. Mm-hmm. Because in addition to everything else, I really was very, I did not want to teach. And I did not want to teach, I think, you know, for some perhaps rational reason, also some neurotic reasons. But first of all, since I did not really know where I was going to be, I couldn't really apply for an academic job, you know, since I was following my husband around. Second of all, I think I was really afraid of teaching. And when I've taught in the future, I mean, I would spend a week, you know, preparing for 1 hour lecture, okay? So, all right, so I decided I was going to be a researcher. So I got a job at the Psychiatric Institute, and, you know, it was marvelous because basically I could do whatever I wanted to, you know. Joe Zubin was my boss.
Oh, okay.
And so I decided that I really wanted to do something in which I could see peer influence manifest itself. And one day I went to a meeting, I think it was the American Psychopathological Association, as a matter of fact, and I met another group from Colombia that I did not know, and they had gotten a grant because somebody, the principal investigator, died. It was a grant to look, oh my God, I don't even remember all the details, and to look at marijuana, to look at the illicit drug use among high school. Wait a second, let me try to remember all the details. I'm trying to think. Hi. They got a grant to take over somebody else's study that was going to be a study of drug use among high school students.
And who was the they?
The they was Jack Allenson and Eric Josephson. And Jack Allenson was a sociologist who had created the Division of Social Medical Sciences here at Columbia. And he really is a very, he's still alive. I mean, he's retired and he comes around. He's a very influential person because he's the one who really, I think, created the field of medical sociology. And this was the first department that really focused upon medical sociology. So he was very important. And in fact, he was on my PhD defense committee. He was one of the people who was on my PhD. Oh, I didn't tell you what my PhD said. My PhD was a study of the decisions of medical students. How do medical students decide on which specialty?
On their specialty.
On their specialty. I never published.
Did you think that you were a medical sociologist?
Yes, I saw that I was a medical sociologist. Yeah.
And so your professional identity was that of a medical sociologist?
More or less, because I'd done my study on the... Okay, I did my study on the medical student project, which is a very famous project that Merton, you know, and Patty Lazarsfeld and so on had done. Yes, but you see, on the other hand, you could also think of it as being a study of the development of young people, of socialization of young people.
Which was, in fact, the direction that you
That's
took
right.
later.
And you see, because I really admired Coleman, I was really thrilled to be able to be part of the studies that I did with Jerry Lesser, and Coleman actually was a consultant. Mm-hmm. I got him to be a consultant to the study, which was, you know, very useful. Mm-hmm. So
now this grant at Columbia, what year did you start working on it? The marijuana grant.
Let me tell you this interesting story. So Josephson and Ellingson had gotten this study because a principal investigator had died. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a study of marijuana use among, I don't know, secondary school students. And so I happened to meet them at the meeting, and when I heard about this, I said, oh, you know, I think we should really join forces because I'm very much interested in the relative influence of parents and peers, and you have money from, you know, they take over the grant. Why don't I join you and I will collect data from the parents? And I get a grant. Well, they thought about it and then they decided they didn't want me to do this because they thought that if the students knew that I was getting data from their parents, they wouldn't tell me the truth, okay? But by that time, I got so interested in the whole idea, I said, okay, I'll apply for my own grant, which was the best thing that ever happened to me. So I applied for my own grant, and I won't forget this. These days, there were site visits, and Peter Rossi, does that name sound familiar? He was one of very, very well-known sociologists, but on a site visit, and I had designed a study which I was going to have, you know, five little schools, and he said, why don't you get the representative sample? So he got me some extra money, and I got a representative sample of the state of New York. And that really is what got me going, because that, you know, I got my own study. It was a very interesting study.
And who funded that?
And the National Institute on Drug Abuse funded that.
In 19?
The study started in 1970. I mean, I collected the data, or maybe 71, something like that.
Okay, but NIDA isn't NIDA till 73.
Yes,
was because it NIMH?
No, because NIDA, it was part of NIMH because there was a little branch, okay, a little section at NIMH that was part, yeah. And then, when did it become?
DNADA, maybe?
Huh?
Maybe it was called DNADA?
Yes, it was called DNADA.
Yes.
So
William Bunny.
Yes, that's it. That's it. So that study really made my reputation, and it turns out that I was funded. It's really interesting from the point of view of the history of science. I was funded to do a study of marijuana use, and as I thought about it, I decided that I also should look at marijuana use and also other illicit drugs. I said, you know, you really have to look at the other drugs, alcohol and cigarettes. Well, I had to hide from my project office that I was going to do this because in those days, you know, if you funded to do marijuana, you couldn't do alcohol and cigarettes, which now is very different because, but still, the institutes are very protective. I mean, you know, you do, the NIA does alcohol and NIDA does, but NIDA does, is very big into tobacco. And that really turned out to be the turning point, I think, of my work and really what set me going. Because what happened is that I developed the notion of stages in drug use. And before I say that, what also happened with this study is I got independent data from the parents and the friends in school, and under my husband's influence, I submitted an article in Science, and it was accepted. But in those days, no social scientist ever published in Science. And my husband—I mean, I must say—you know, my husband, you know, didn't wash the dishes in those days. Now there's everything around the house, but he certainly was very influential in really, you know, telling me sometimes what to do. I never would have had the idea of submitting to Science.
You jumped to my question, which was going to be, how did you get that into Science?
Well, once he told me to, I don't know, I said, maybe he actually revised it, helped me revise it, I don't know. I got into Science, it wasn't very difficult. In fact, I have two publications in Science. And in those days, no social scientist ever published in Science. I mean, now it's much more common. Mm-hmm. But in those days, nobody did this. And I think that was really very important. And so that was parents and peers. And the second one that I did, which was a 1975 article, I think it's the most important thing perhaps that I've done, I don't know, which was this notion of stages in drug use. And this has given rise to the so-called gateway hypothesis. And this, you know, I did not name it this way. And at the beginning, I did not like the term, but now, of course, everybody uses it, so now I'm embracing it.
But it would it be fair to say that it emerged in retrospect, or how?
No, I think what happened is I use the term stages and sequences. I think that was the title of the article. I think that it's Bob DuPont who, in one of the, you know, news sheets, I've been trying to try to see where the term first appeared, because I'm sure that it appeared in a government or some kind of news sheets or something like that. But, you know, I wrote a book in 19... I held a conference. The book appeared in 2002, which was kind of on the gateway hypothesis. And I tried to figure out, you know, when the term was first used and in which context. And I couldn't really pin it down.
Yes.
And so, you know, I don't have time to do it. If I had time, well, I would try to look into it. But anyway, so... Now, of course, it's used in so many different ways, in ways I don't even like it. But basically, the way it was meant to say is that there's a sequence of involvement in drugs that starts with a legal drug, that proceeds with the illicit drug, but there's a really clear-cut order in the illicit drugs. Marijuana, and then, you know, maybe cocaine, and then the other drug. It's harder to find determine the orders among the illicit drugs. But now, it's used, you know, like... Gateway, okay, you go from cocaine to heroin. You know, I think it's lost a lot of things, but...
Let's stay in the 70s, and we'll get there. I read the book, so I'm happy to get there. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, when you were making sense of that study, did the way you just said it, clear process of involvement, et cetera, did that occur to you then?
It
emerged that clearly.
Oh, yes, very clearly. But, and you know, the idea of, I must say, my husband didn't wash the dishes, but certainly he was very important in other ways. The idea of publishing in Science was completely his idea. Especially once you have one article, you're more, you know, involved to set the other article. But I think the fact that it appeared in Science was really extremely influential. And you know, I never go and look at the citation. I don't know how many times it's been cited, this article, but I would think it must have been cited quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm one of the highly cited people, but you know, there are so many social people who are among the most highly cited. It doesn't mean anything. But anyway, you know, you have favorite articles in your life. This is, really, I guess, one of my favorite articles. And it's amazing how well it's held, because there are people, like you said, you've interviewed Bruce Johnson, okay? So he's one of the people who tries to kind of, I don't want to say destroy, but, kind of, you know, say it really doesn't hold. But if you look at it, you know, there are patterns that don't always fall. There are certain people who don't always follow, but so maybe among certain, you know, African Americans and so on. But they're a minority. The majority of the people follow this sequence. You found it in so many different countries that it's really, you know, amazing. And in fact, I'm doing some work now. I'm going to be doing work with my husband. The first time we got to collaborate together, trying to get at the molecular biology of this. It's going to be fantastic.
Oh, that's so we will come to that.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm telling you, we have done pilot studies. I mean, we have a grant. I just submitted the grant in February together with my husband. The first time we've collaborated. I don't know if it's good or bad for marriage.
That's right. So did the impetus for that project, had it originally come from the mental health sort of folks at NIMH?
Which project?
That was your project, right?
To do the study of... No, my study was parental and peer influence in adolescent drug use. That was completely my thing. And I never, the idea of stages of drug use, it's not something that I started with that idea in mind, and I'm trying to figure out how I thought about this. I'm not even sure exactly.
That must have emerged somehow from the data.
But the problem is, you know, how does it emerge from the data? I mean, I haven't thought about it. Maybe I need to think some more, but I don't really recall how I came up with this idea. But you see, the other thing is, when I proposed the idea, I didn't have longitudinal data. So it was on the basis of cross-sectional data and age of onset and so on. I haven't looked back at this article, but I think I had a diagram or something. I kind of had like synthetic cohorts. So I'm losing track. What is the question you asked me?
I'm trying to get at how you got to stages and sequences.
How I did drop the term, I don't know, because this was in the title of the article in Science. It's called Stages and Sequences, I think, if I recall. Mm-hmm. I think it was based, I should reread the article. I don't even remember how I did the analysis, but I think it was looking at people who, it wasn't that as sophisticated as it would be done now, I'm sure. But once you saw the pattern, it was really very, very strong. Now, of course, there are always deviations among certain groups and so on. But anyway.
So what was our state of knowledge about adolescent drug use at that time? Who else was studying it? How were they studying it?
There were a number of people, because what's interesting, I think, at the time that I did my study, there were a number of other longitudinal studies. There was Dick Jesser, there were Howard Kaplan, there were a number of other people. But nobody was thinking in terms of stages. Mm-hmm. Jesser had this idea of... I think that this was a completely original idea.
Mm-hmm. So anything in your... Had you had any kind of prior contact with...
But I just want to tell you one more thing, that the reason I submitted in Science is because of my husband.
Yes.
He completely told me, try science.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So had you had any kind of contact with addicted persons prior to that time?
No, but that's another thing. I don't have contact even now. I have the thing sometimes, I'm almost a fraud, I do this work, but I don't know anybody who's addicted. And, I smoked a cigarette for 6 months when I was in college to be sophisticated, so I've never tried marijuana. My brother is 5 years younger, of course, has tried marijuana. I've never tried an illicit drug.
So, and you didn't have any friends who had children who had become involved with drugs or...
No, when I started my work, my children were a year and a half or two,
Yes.
No, they weren't adolescents. No, I didn't know anybody who started to use drugs. I liked drugs because I thought it would be a good... I was interested in the theoretical ideas of parental versus peer influences. Mm-hmm. And when I had done the study with Lesser, it was clear that parents were much more influential than peers in the development of education aspirations. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to find a behavior in which you could see the influence of peers. And I saw that drug use would be a very good behavior, which in fact it is.
Mm-hmm. So your interest was in it as a scientific...
It was a completely theoretical thing. And you see, the evolution of my career is I started being very much interested in this intellectual issue of who is more influential, parents or peers, in terms of adolescent development. And Coleman had kind of developed this notion of the adolescent gap in which parents were completely separate from their turn, and I thought you had to have a more nuanced perspective, and I was interested in the relative influence of parents and peers and the domains in which they would manifest themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I went to drug use from a theoretical point of view. But in the evolution of my career, I would say that drug use has not taken over, and I don't really care about parents versus peers from a theoretical point of view. I'm much more interested in the phenomenon per se and become much more interested in the biology of it.
Mm-hmm. As time has gone.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And you know, the thing that's amazing about the biology is that, well, that, I guess, is this under the influence of my husband maybe, but, social behavior is completely determined by biological processes. I mean, there's this woman who's done these experiments on worms, and depending upon, what she does to their genes, they either eat by themselves or they eat in a group.
I'll be thinking about that when I'm dining alone tonight. We will get to that. The field of drug etiology.
Yes.
Do you regard that as your field, or how?
Right now, no. But first of all, I will tell you one thing. I guess I'm not answering your question directly. I guess what my field, quote-unquote, that the people identify with has really changed dramatically over time. When I started, my point of reference was sociologists or social psychologists, people who did things like, you know, Jesser, I guess, was one of the major people, and Howard Kaplan. I don't know, Howard Kaplan has completely disappeared from the scene. And so, I was very much interested in that. But over time, I'm much more interested in the behavior per se and trying to understand, you know. But there are people, even to these days, I mean, it's really unbelievable. Eric Good, who is Cy Good's, his father was a very famous sociologist. I mean, even now you think that biological factors are actually no important in understanding drug behavior. And in those days, if you were to say that drug behavior may have a biological basis, I mean, that was considered to be heretical.
In sociology. And psychology.
In sociology or even epidemiology.
Yes, yes.
And so you were supposed to be a traitor, you know, if you were to think that, oh, there might be a biological basis, and no, it's all socially determined.
So when would you say you came out as someone who thought that there was a biological basis?
Oh, well, from the very beginning. Not that I took it into account, not even then, I'm not really taking into account. I mean, I collected saliva. I'm going to try to do DNA analysis if I get funds to do that. But I guess, all along I've been influenced by my husband, hearing him talk and so on. But actually, I think modern biologists feel there is no difference really between nature and nurture. I mean, it's kind of such a strong interaction.
Yes, yes.
But of course, you know, it's like Huntington's disease. If you have a certain number of repeats, then there's 100% chance that you're going to have it. If you have fewer repeats, then maybe there's a role for environmental factors or as biological factors.
Yes, yes. So, but in the 1970s, was it simply that sociologists had achieved a certain kind of dominance within the governmental, within NIDA?
Oh, no, because a lot of the people doing the work were psychologists. I think there would be more psychologists than sociologists doing it.
Yes, yes.
That's the case.
Yeah.
And the sociologists tend to do more epidemiological type studies.
And you were involved with NIDA, well, SEODAP and NIDA, when NIDA, sort of at the birth of NIDA, right? You did some work, and can you describe that?
Well, I don't remember. I mean, I was on many different committees, and I was on...
Various kinds of review committees?
Yeah, no, not the review committees. Now I'm on a review committee. No, I was not on a review committee, but I was on council. You know, they forever had workshops and things, so I was there. But then I was on council for 4 years and some other kind of scientific research, something. I don't even remember. It's in my VT.
And did you find at the time, were you marginal or were you central to those kinds of processes? Do you remember feeling like your work was part of the priorities of NIDA?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think, you know, DuPont wrote an editorial. No, I think that the notion of stages, I think that's the most important thing, perhaps, that I've done.
Yes, in terms of a conceptual contribution.
And it's, you know, it's really has, yeah, long terms, and even now, you know, I'm going to try to test it biologically. No, it's really is a, perhaps the most important thing that I've done. And I got the PACET Award for that. Oh, that was 1979, I think I got it. So I've been in the field for a very long time.
Yes. So that work, you continued through the 1970s and 1980s.
Yes, and you see, let me just try to tell you something else I always tried to do when I did this work, is I realized it was an applied topic. But I always tried to frame it within a kind of, and I don't do this now, always try to frame it into a kind of more theoretical perspective that would make it part of the mainstream work. And I'm, I think, one of the few people working in the drug field that got my were published, you know, American Sociological Review, American Journal of Sociology, on drugs, which, yes. you know, is kind of was unheard of, because there's a hierarchy of topics in science. I can tell you that as far as sociologists is concerned, drug use is at the very bottom. So now maybe it's changing a little bit. I don't know. But
do you care to speculate on why?
No, I never. Well, I have a feeling that in sociology, the most prestigious topics were education and political system. So if you did something related to education, something related, that was very prestigious. Criminology, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But drug use was really the bottom. And maybe it reflects the status, you know, of drug abusers in society.
Yes. Yes. It's interesting, even scientific research, even the pharmacologists, et cetera, at that period, similar thing. There, if you look at the hierarchies of credibility, you'll see.
No, it has the lowest prestige.
Yes.
And but on the other hand, you know, I think it's quite interesting, because I think it's a behavior in which you can really try to see how biology and social processes operate more than, you know, because you actually have a biological agent.
Yes.
Not that I've done that in my work, which I would like to do. But.
Yes, I've often thought that drugs offered an arena for sociologists to do precisely that. For many years, you can see drugs as a kind of you can work out certain kinds of problems.
Yeah.
With drugs.
But you see, I did that much more in the other part of my career than now. I mean, I guess over the last 10 years, I've become much more applied and focused upon, you know, the phenomenon of drug dependence per se. But at the beginning, I was very much concerned in terms of trying to frame problems in basic social science terms. And so, for instance, I've always been very interested in peer influence. And so most of the work on peer influence, you know, you don't really can ascertain it properly, because what you do is you look at the association similarity in the behaviors of friends, people who associate together. But that, of course, could reflect two different processes. People choose each other, they have similar values and they choose each other as friends, or they associate with each other, they influence each other, selection versus influence. And so I as you go through your career, there are little articles that you like better than others, but this one is one of my favorites. I was able to identify when I did my next study, when I did the logical component of the study, I identified the longitudinal sample of peers, of friends, and friends to be, and so I was able to really parse out or identify, and Coleman helped me statistically how to do it, what would be selection and what would be influence.
And which article was that?
This is in the American Journal of Sociology.
Uh-huh.
See, in those days, I mean, if you published American Journal of Sociology,
yes.
or American Sociological Review, that was really the top. Because as far as my husband is concerned, it's science. But and now he doesn't think it's science, by the way. it's interesting, but anyway.
So through the 1970s, you were given quite a natural sample. I mean, you had a group, you had...
It wasn't given, I selected it. It was hard work.
But yes, but you had an epidemic, in a sense, to track. You had a social phenomenon to which you had access, right? When things began to switch from heroin, for instance, to cocaine, to marijuana, right, et cetera, did that show up for you?
No,
or
no,
not?
Okay, you're talking about, you know, I cannot see, no, yeah, the rates of heroin use are very low in the population, and they really are, the heroin users are in certain pockets. When you have a representative sample of high school students, you're not going to have heroin users. It's too, I mean, you have a few. No, so I focus mainly on marijuana and all the illicit drugs lumped together.
Yes. Okay.
You can't really,
because heroin just doesn't show up enough sample.
You don't have enough people to do anything with it.
Right.
Especially
so
when I did the longitudinal sample, you know, I selected a subsample. I didn't have enough money to do everything, so I think I had 1,200 people. I forget how many I had.
1,000.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you began, when you were doing these this kind of studies, you had...
Come in.
What time is it?
Do you
want to
take a phone call from
Daniel? Yeah.
How did you organize the studies? You were doing some portion of the labor. Obviously, other people, you had graduate students, you had research.
You mean all the different studies?
Associates.
Well, okay. Generally, the studies that I do involve, well, there are two different types of studies that I do. One is studies in which I collect the data myself. And these studies tend to be large-scale studies in which I have a subcontract, in which the actual data collection is done by a subcontractor, NORC, National Opinion Research Center. They are one of the top, you know, survey research outfits in the country, and I must be now their longest client. And so I get, I get the money to pay them, and they do all the data collection and data processing and so on. And then I have, you know, if I have, depending upon the amount of money that I have graduate students, or I have, and I always have full-time PhD types mm-hmm. working with me.
Mm-hmm. And have you come to see yourself as a teacher over the years?
Yes and no. I'm not very good as a teacher. Because, I mean, I teach the people who work with me, you know, today. I'm not very good in a classroom because I don't know, I guess I'm frightened and I have to spend too much time preparing. I'm always afraid somebody's going to ask me a question. I'm not going to know the answer, so I don't like to teach in a classroom.
I see.
But, you know, I've had postdoctoral fellow and things like that.
Yeah, so now what were you doing through the 1980s?
Through the 1980s. Can I look at my vitae? But I think that, okay, first of all, I did a survey. I had done a large-scale survey of high school students, and then I selected a subsample that I followed, and I followed them until they were in their mid-30s. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things. Oh, I had the list of all my grants. I don't know mm-hmm. what, I don't want to give it to you. But so that would refresh my memory. Let me see. And, oh, yes, and then I got money, the 1980s, okay, then I got money to do a cross-cultural study in France and in Israel, mm-hmm. because one of the major findings of the study was that peer influences were much more important than parental influences. And so I wanted to see what would happen in different countries. Mm-hmm. And I selected Israel and France because Israel has the lowest rate of alcohol use, France has the highest, and I want to see how this will work out. What I also did is, and I've continued to do this, I would do secondary analysis of large data sets, like for instance, the National Household Survey on Drug Abuse. I've done a lot of work on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And tell me, what were you looking for by doing secondary analysis of the household survey?
Because you have a much larger sample. And also, I started becoming interested not only in use, but in abuse. Mm. And in order to do an dependence, in order to do an addiction, which is another term, dependence is another term for addiction, mm-hmm. in order to do this, you really need to have very large samples. And the household survey provided an opportunity to do that. Of course, the thing that's maddening is, you know, you have the mercy of how to define the variables, and of course, you don't have very many different variables. They spend so much time in the interview assessing drug behavior that you don't have many other variables besides drug behavior to mm-hmm. look at.
Yes, yes. And is it...
But I've also, yeah.
The move from use to dependence, would it be fair to characterize you as across your career having moved from being use, yeah. interested in use to dependence.
Yes. And that's why I really went into tobacco. I went into tobacco because I thought that it was a drug at the beginning of the process. The work that I had done on stage of drug use had showed that alcohol and cigarettes were the two drugs with which children started their experimentation. And I decided to focus on tobacco because I thought that would be easier to characterize than alcohol use. Alcohol, you know, has beer and wine and hard liquor and so on, so it's very complicated. And I thought tobacco would be
that would
easier.
Be simple.
Oh, well, it's not that simple either. Nothing is simple. And so I thought that by focusing on the first step, and that by focusing on the first step in the process, you know, I was debating between alcohol and tobacco, the sound tobacco, I would have a better handle in trying to understand, you know, what are the factors that are operating. Because if you start with marijuana, you have all the factors that lead people into alcohol, into cigarettes, into progression. So I started looking at tobacco.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start doing that?
I started doing that, I would say, about 10 years ago.
Mid-90s?
Yes.
Okay.
So then I thought that I was designing the ultimate study of my career. It turned out to be, I don't know, half a disaster, but I got a fantastic amount of money from NIDA and also from the Cancer Institute and from the Legacy Foundation to do this study that's a study of what I'm doing of the factors related to nicotine dependence. I became interested in understanding addiction or dependence in contrast to use per se. And, you know, every research project that you end up doing, I think, is a compromise between what it is that you want to do and what it is that's going to be funded. So I wanted to do a study that would start at the beginning with people who had not smoked, and then they would start to smoke, and then they would, you know, you see how dependence develops. But it would be much too expensive and much too time-consuming to do this because you have to start with a large number of people. Sample. Anyway, so I got funded to do this study in which I would focus mainly on new tobacco smokers, users, with a very small number of non-users, so I would not have to tell parents and kids that it's a study of smokers when I ask for permission. And I got funded, and before I applied, I got the cooperation of 5 schools in Westchester, and they were going to participate in the study. And when I went back to the schools, as I was getting ready to go into the field, you know, I was developing the instruments, but you didn't have to get the final permission to get into the schools. It turns out that there's a woman who is not part of the school. She gets grants from the state. She provides drug education programs and drug prevention programs in the schools. She got involved. She saw herself as being, you know, whatever. And she insisted on reviewing the instrument, got extremely upset about some of the questions. For instance, to tell you, there was a question about, we had a scale of pubertal development because we want to know to what extent involvement, heavy involvement is related to pubertal development and sexual maturation. And she got, you know, concerned about some of the questions about pubertal development, whether you have pubic hair and so on. Okay. She got concerned about the questions that we had about psychiatric disorders, because one aspect of the studies are very much interested in comorbidity between psychiatric disorders and drug use. And so, to make a long story short, we really negotiated with her, and, you know, I became like a mat and gave up this question, that question. So we came back from the meeting and we had agreed, even though I'd given up a great deal. In the meantime, I was developing the instrument, you know, because we were working on a schedule. We're supposed to go to the school in the beginning of the academic year. And the next morning, as I was preparing a letter, you know, recapitulating our agreement, I got a letter from her saying she couldn't sleep the whole night, and she
Cannot abide by what we agreed on, and she's withdrawing her support from the study, and she's going to write to the principals. So we lost 3 out of the 5 schools we're going to have. And so ended up, in the meantime, we were developing the instrument and had eliminated a lot of stuff that we wanted to have. And so we ended up being able to go into the Chicago schools because of our subcontract, which was NORC, which got us into the Chicago schools, which was good and bad, because it was a representative sample with oversampling of the Chicago school, but the Chicago schools are 90% minority, so we had ended up with a very small percentage. We have a high percentage, we have a percentage of whites, which is much higher than the percentage in the Chicago school system, because we did a lot of oversampling. And so this study, which I thought was going to, I was so excited about this study, which I thought was going to be, you know, the ultimate study I've ever done, turning out to be a nightmare. Mm. Because along every step, there have been problems, so we couldn't get into the schools, we had to emasculate the instrument. So this is a longitudinal study. The first wave is very different from the other waves. And then it turns out that there was a tremendous amount of underreporting. So we selected these kids because they said they were smokers, and we got into the household. They said they never smoked. So that study turns out to be, I thought it was going to be the best study I've ever did, but I'm not sure.
Let's go back a bit. You did a study, as I understand it, it was an attempt to account for the marijuana use epidemic in the 1990s of parental influence.
This was a secondary analysis of the household survey.
Yeah, this was parent-child dyad.
Yes, yes.
And can you tell me a little bit? I was surprised. It did not confirm the hypothesis that you went into it with. Were you surprised?
No, because what happened is the government was interested in testing this idea that, I haven't thought about this, so I'm not sure I can describe it in great detail. They were interested in the so-called marijuana epidemic, and they gave us access to... Okay, let me backtrack. The government...
This is NIDA?
This study started with NIDA, but then it was taken over by SAMHSA.
Yes.
And so SAMHSA, when they collect their sample, they have individuals who are 12 to 17, and then they have adults in the population 18 and over. And so the way they did the sampling, it turns out by chance that there were households in which a child and a parent were selected. So it's not really a representative sample of children, but so they gave us access. They gave us a data file that had the links between the parents and the children. And so we use those data from something like 10 different surveys to try to see, you know, whether there was a special, whether there was something special about the baby boom generation, you know, that would lead to greater similarity between parents and children. And we didn't find this.
Did that surprise you?
Well, I didn't know what to expect. But interestingly enough, you know, we wanted to use that same data set to look at parent-child agreement on smoking. And they don't want us to do it. They only want us to do it. I had to sign a big contract that they would have to try to reuse, and then so in the end, I've not done it. And in the end, I'm going to do it just on a subsample of this. Okay. I'm getting to a lot of very detail. It turns out that in some of the years, the public use data tape had the data that you needed to link the parents and the kids. But in other survey years, there weren't, and I forget what the years were, between 91 and 99, there may have been 2 or 3 surveys for which you did not have the link on the public use data tape, and they gave it to us. So the baby boom generation report is based upon this complete data set. But now I have a data set which is in the public use domain, which I've analyzed, but I have not, you know, written it up yet.
in which I'm looking at the parent-child similarity in smoking and nicotine dependence. I'm very much interested. See, what happens is, over time, my interest shifted from just use to dependence, which has more of a biological basis to it.
Why do you think you shifted?
You know, I don't know whether I'm influenced maybe by the ethos of the time or whether, I don't really know. I think people are becoming much more interested now in addiction. The epidemiologists are becoming much more addiction than just in use per se, because they see that the consequences, the social and biological consequences of, you know, dependence or addiction, whichever way you define it, and that's another problem, are much more problematic than casual use. And I would say that this is one of the weaknesses of the Monitoring the Future study, you know, that they don't really have a good measure of dependence. And because they are so concerned about, well, I don't want to criticize them, but and it's just a comment actually. They're so concerned about keeping the same instrument. And also they are constrained, they are measuring they're going to the school, so they have a limited amount of time. But you know, if you look closely at the way in which they ask the question, they say, how many times have you used Lifetime last year, last month? And it's the same set of responses for all three time periods. That doesn't make sense. You know, Lifetime you could use 500 times or 1,000 times.
So you didn't think of what you were doing as convergent with Monitoring the Future? And with
no, it's not at all convergent with Monitoring the Future. Because, first of all, what Monitoring the Future is very unusual in, it's their strengths. They do not change their instrument, okay? So you can be sure that what they find is not due to the difference in instrument, but it's due to the fact that that people change. This is not the same with the household survey. They are impossible. They are forever changing instrument. And now, for instance, they've done something which is closely related to my interest. They've changed the definition of nicotine dependence. This started in the year 2000, if I'm not incorrect. And what they did up to then is that they have a DSM-4 version, of an instrument to measure dependence on each class of drug. And, you know, there's always kind of discussion as to what's the best way to measure addiction or dependence. And perhaps there's more disagreement in the field of nicotine than perhaps for the other substances. So there's a person by the name of Saul Schiffman who's developed his own scale. It's called the NDSS, I forget what it's called, Nicotine Dependence Symptom Scale. And he convinced the person who runs the household survey to include the scale instead of the DSM-4 version. But what they did, you know, it's in the past when they sometimes used a different version, like for instance, there used to be a time in which they asked the smoking questions as a, you know, asked by the interviewer and answered by the respondent, whereby for all the other drugs, it's self-administered. So the year when they shifted, they wanted to shift from oral to self-administration, they had a relatively small sample of 4,000 or 5,000 people in which they had both, so you could compare. Here, they all of a sudden introduce NDSS and they drop the thing. Furthermore, the NDSS is developed as a continuous scale. So they had to find a cutoff point because the whole thing about the notion of dependence, you know, is a kind of an absolute dichotomous state.
So let's see.
Forget where we got.
So in some ways, the work with tobacco, with nicotine dependence, hasn't panned out as you had hoped it would.
Oh no! I mean, it's turned out to be much more difficult. I think you see that there are all these inconsistencies depending upon the mode of data collection. But people very rarely have an opportunity to compare what happens when they have the same subjects and they ask them the same questions or similar questions under different conditions, and you can get dramatically different responses. Because in one case, for instance, when you have the school survey, it's in school, so it's completely anonymous, more or less, even though they had to construct a code number. But when you're in the household, even though the parents are not present, you know, I think there's a constraint of the parents being there.
Yes.
So what's turned out to be, it's been that every time we try to approach an analytical question, we have to do a lot of methodological work to try to understand what goes on. I think other people might have the same biases in their data, but because they don't have the school data, they're not able to realize
to
that they have
that.
The yeah,
yes.
To see that. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So do you think, in terms of the emergence of adolescent drug users, do you think that there has been, you've really seen, you've had a career of
mm-hmm.
seeing the emergence of the adolescent drug user.
Mm-hmm.
In the recent, I think it was the household data, that there was recently the claim that perhaps we're looking at the wrong thing. Maybe adolescence isn't so important, that adult drug use makes more sense to look at that. Do you think that
who
there has
that
been
claim?
To the New York Times editorial?
When was this?
January of this year.
Yeah, an editorial in the New York
there
Times.
There was an editorial. Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't see it.
No, I disagree with that completely.
So
I don't know. What did they say in the editorial before I disagree? I continue to disagree. Yeah.
Basically, that the household survey is set up to look in the wrong place. That by looking at adolescents, we are not seeing the greater problem of adult drug use. So tell me why.
Wait a second.
Right, adolescent drug use remains an important place
this
to look.
This is a nonsensical statement, because the sampling frame for the household survey is age 12 and over. So they have 12 to 17, they present the data 12 to 17, mm-hmm. 18 to 25, 25, blah, blah, blah. So I don't understand what this story is all about. They are looking at the whole range mm-hmm. of subjects. So you can't say they're only looking at adolescents. You have to look at adolescents, because that's when it starts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't start as adolescent for tobacco, for instance, you never smoke.
Right.
So I don't understand.
So you think that the adolescent drug user will remain an important object of scientific study?
Oh, I think so. I think so.
Okay.
I think, oh yes, because from many different points of views, because first of all, when you start in adolescence, it has much more long-term and negative consequences than when you start in adulthood. And, you know, there's been very exciting work now that's been done on animals, because basically a lot of this work has been done on animals. And a lot of work done, and more, I'm familiar, quite familiar with the work that's done on nicotine, and I think, I don't know that the similar work has been done on other drugs, but it's really remarkable that this work has been done on mice, some on rats, but now, so what people have done is they've compared first administration of nicotine in adolescence versus adulthood. So, you know, in a rat, adolescence is a very short period. It's very hard to do these experiments. And what they found is really fantastic. That first of all, that if you compare the adolescents and the adult rats who are first exposed to nicotine, the adolescents have a much stronger reaction. And furthermore, if you follow those adolescents into adulthood, they have a much more stronger reaction than the adults who are first exposed to nicotine in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
So that the first experience in adolescence is extremely important. And there may be some things about the way in which the brain is organized that can explain these results.
Mm-hmm.
But that is now coming out as a very systematic set of findings which come in from different laboratories. Ed Levin is a very important person. He's at Duke.
And when, yes.
He's supported by Philip Morris money, but anyway.
When did you first become interested in animal models?
Oh, I mean,
I think when I started reading the literature on smoking, I became quite interested, and I submitted a grant with my husband, the first time we submitted together, and I was a postdoc, and we got to look at molecular changes that are, you know, that occur with smoking.
And had you followed the work, the sort of behavioral pharmacology work on nicotine that Jack Henningfield and Roland Griffiths, so the Hopkins behavioral pharmacologists, did a lot of that?
Wait a second. Where did they find? Wait a second.
I mean, they're the people who.
But Henningfield does mainly policy at this point.
At this point, yes. But I mean, his work in the 1980s was really showing that there was nicotine dependence, and mainly in animal models.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
So your interest would have come later than that.
Yeah, much later, yes. And much more recent.
And are you, in reading the Gateway Hypothesis book, your 2002 edited collection, you sort of had, well, okay, there's cross-cultural validity, there's longitudinal validity, there are animal models of the Gateway Hypothesis. What did you have in mind?
Well, you see, it's interesting. The concluding chapter was written in collaboration with Dick Jesser.
Yes.
And he censored what I wanted to say.
What did you want to say?
Well, I wanted to emphasize animal models, and that does not appear in there. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, this is typical. And my response is also typical. He said, well, if you're going to talk about animal models, I'm going to write my own chapter. I think this is ridiculous. It's going to be my chapter and your chapter. What are you going to, you know, this doesn't make sense. So basically, I agreed to remove that. And now I'm really very...
Why was he so adamant?
Oh, because... And now, of course, he realized, and now he says, oh, he was wrong. Because all along, I mean, he only wanted to present a kind of social, psychological, non-biological perspective, basically. And I really kicked in on that. And he's the one who had the idea that there should be a conference. So I organized it, and then I asked him to join me in writing the concluding chapter, but never did I realize that he would be the outcome. And in retrospect, I'm really sorry that I caved in.
Because
I think this major point that I wanted to make was not included. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I should have said, write your own chapter. But
That's an interesting story, because it's in many ways it's kind of where you're going with
this is why I am so, and then, you know, I've written a couple of editorials now afterwards. In which I point out that the next step is really animal models, and but never did I think that I could do it at the molecular level.
Yes. So what do you think it would take for the Gateway Hypothesis to become something more than a hypothesis?
Well, that's what we're going to do.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
That's the intent of that work. And what do you think you have to show in order to do that?
I think you have to really. You see, what happens is that you can always say that the sequence is due to social factors. And so, first of all, even from a social point, if you just look at social variables, I mean, if you can show that there are as many people who go, you know, from marijuana to cigarettes as to go from cigarettes to marijuana, then that already would be some kind of documentation that there's nothing biological about it. It's just a matter of, you know, opportunity. But if you do work with animals and you give them drug A and then drug B and they respond in a certain way, and you give them B and then A and they don't respond in the same way, I mean, that really, as far as I can say, is the ultimate proof. And you can also, if you do certain molecular analysis, you can really identify what is a really the molecular process that gives rise to this.
So if you're going to do this, doesn't it entail retooling in some way?
Well, this is a problem. The problem is that I feel I provide, you know, the basic ideas, but I cannot do the biological work. And it's really interesting because we wrote the grant, you know, and I did a lot of the grant writing, and I was amazed that I could contribute as much as I did. And my husband said, no, you know, it's critical, you're providing the basic ideas, this and that. But basically, the work is done by, you know, a postdoctoral fellow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I say I should spend 3 months in the lab to try to learn, but I don't think I would be able to understand the molecular biology, as the
honest. Yes, yes.
But I'm really very thrilled about this. Because this is, you know, testing it at the most basic level. And I think it's going to work.
Yes, and you would like to see that confirmed.
Of course. But this is where the biases of the scientists come in, you know. When you look at a table, you know, are you going to say, oh, there was a joke that you said 10%.